Thank you. Okay, we are looking at investigating the history of Baptist churches here in America. And to do that, they came over and started in the colonies here in North America in the late 1600s and the early 1700s. I want to go back to a statement or two that J.T. Christian makes. If you have volume one, chapter 17, I know it's in a couple of different, we have a couple of different versions of the book, or at least page numbers. They're all the same version, I think. Chapter 17 of volume one, we have considered baptism and the importance, a lot of the discussion and debates of what was scriptural baptism during that time, both in England and here in the United States. I'm going to go to the second paragraph of this 17th chapter. We're going to look at, and for me, it's just a page turn, a couple of paragraphs to look at and consider because of the importance of baptism and of fellowship and of being able to trace lineage properly. In the opening paragraph, he refers to and begins just as a basic foundation, the discussion about John Smyth again. The administrator for baptism was a large topic of discussion and debate in the middle 1600s in England. The second paragraph of this chapter reads this way: "It is now time to consider the history of another body of Baptists who, if not so numerous, were at least highly influential. They were called Particular Baptists." That's how they're going to be referred to. Christian gives quite a bit of attention to them. "They were called Particular Baptists since they held to Calvinistic view, generally of predestination, and how that only some would be saved. And so they were not real outgoing and trying to evangelize and win others, even though they were fairly numerous and did grow during this time. But still concerning baptism, it goes on and it reads, two views of the administrator of baptism prevailed among them." Some of that we've already looked at and discussed. I'll read through this paragraph. "The first and the oldest was that every Christian man could, without himself having been baptized, immerse a candidate upon a profession of faith." Okay. Baptists in England practiced a lot of particular Baptists. That was what they held to. "Later, they were those who held that an administrator should have a succession from a previously baptized administrator. And so baptism wasn't recognized from church to church. But baptism was still such an issue in that 17th century in England that if it wasn't an ordained minister who baptized them, regardless of what their profession was, it was unscriptural baptism and wouldn't be accepted." Okay. "At times, these two views came in conflict with and caused much trouble and some discussion. The particular Baptists had a wholly different origin from the general Baptists. Some individuals in the chapter prior prior to this, and the second one comes up. That's not my particular interest in reading this, but I wanted to bring this point out since he's mentioning it here. It's in the next, within the next paragraph or two that I'm going to read that I really want to get to, though. The particular Baptists had a different origin from General Baptists, some coming from Holland, some from Germany, that were really had came from some of the Protestants even during that time and not from Baptists. It must not be thought that either of these parties were new. The historian Crosby states it may be proper to observe here that there have been two parties of English Baptists ever since the beginning of the Reformation, and so for at least 300 years during this time. Those that have allowed and followed Calvinistic scheme of doctrines, and from the principal points therein, personal election, probably the biggest one, personal election and predestination. And so then have been termed particular Baptists. And then those that have professed an Arminian or Remonstrant tenets, and these also form in the chief of those doctrines a universal redemption, and they've been called general Baptists. A universal redemption, not that everyone was saved, but that salvation wasn't limited to just those predestined. That's really the difference between these particular and general Baptists. And I don't want to give a whole lot of attention except just to acknowledge that he speaks about both of those in the book and follows their history to a point. Write this question down if you're taking notes this evening, Ben. Are we particular or are we general Baptists?
Neither.
Write that down, huh?
Neither.
And even though Christian follows the history of both of those groups, his very next statement and the very next paragraph goes on to state this. There were likewise many Baptists in England who did not choose to assume either name, and then in quotations from another history, he quotes, because they receive what they think to be truth without regarding with what human schemes it agrees or disagrees. In other words, they weren't going to conform and submit to either the particular Baptists or the general Baptists, because what they had always practiced and preached, that the gospel be available and made available to all men by grace, is what they held to. And so they remained independent and isolated Baptists. Sometimes in history, they'll be identified as particular Baptists or general Baptists because of some of their tendencies, but they refused to be called either one because they weren't going to associate or hold to those tenets in an absolute manner. Their statement was at the time, and I bring this up because these other Baptists that he talked about, and he explains later in this chapter, without going into great detail, you almost have to remember this first page when you read the rest of this chapter to get the understanding of this, but then it becomes pretty clear if you have this identified right here. They didn't associate with and didn't even become part of the particular or the general associations, but remained separate within their own fellowship of churches because they were independent and weren't going to submit to doctrinally or in the associations. The association didn't mean near as much to them as just fellowshipping with those that they agreed with and not changing any of their doctrine or even the way that they stated their doctrines. They were independent Baptists, okay, which is nearly what we are now. I have been called sometimes by those within our own word, a new lighter and a Calvinist, and because of some absolute statements that I've made while teaching, that those can be taken just individual statements and sometimes be made to sound Calvinistic if you don't listen to the whole message. I mean, if you only take out one or two statements, that's dishonest. But that's the reality of, and I bring all that up because when you're reading through history, sometimes even our churches that we trace our lineage to will even be spoken of or identified, classified with the particular Baptist as being Calvinist. But through a majority of their history, it's fairly easy to see that they were not. And so there have always been. That's why I like this. It's right in the middle of the next page of that 17th chapter for me, and I've just got it highlighted a couple of different ways so I don't miss it and I know where and how easy it can go back to it again. Because this explains a whole lot of history that if you don't know and understand, it's easy to write off. And even what modern critics will tell you, well, you can't trace your succession and your lineage back yet. Yes, you can, because there have been churches that have remained faithful even in light of. But the majority of what most popular Baptists, and just interesting, as much as we have searched out even our own lineage decades back, the more studying these histories and going back through some of those particular churches, the first ones here in the United States, I get even more excited because even if they're called particular Baptists, they were not Calvinists. Even if they were called some other things and associated with, they remained separate and pulled out from, sometimes even before, by their own records, the dates and when those things are that they're accused of, because they weren't going to be a part of what was going on in the majority of those churches, either in an association or a group of churches. It's interesting to me how even in Europe and in the 13 colonies and then the original states here in the United States, how independent most of those Baptists were, even though they still thrived and continued as independents. Okay, Sister Rhonda.
Well, just an example, there's a man who wrote a book called Baptist in Oregon, his name's last name's Wardeen. And in that book, he claims that the Baptists used fermented wine in the Lord's Supper until Prohibition. And he documents some exact documents from the University of Oregon that I've actually seen the documents, and they do not say what it says they say. And so he refers to those things. So when you're reading history, as you're saying, you have to be really careful. And there are a lot of original documents that could be examined in different places, not just here in Oregon. But when you can, it's good to look back at those original documents, because a lot of times they don't say what they're accused of saying.
I've had the same experience. People just that make accusations and will even claim to quote history or claim particular authors or historians, but when you go and look at what they're quoting, they misquote and it's misrepresented. Matter of fact, they say just the opposite of what they're stating. Don't be afraid to go back and look at those sources when they're available. Brother Dixon.
So I know our lineage, probably several other churches in here, we tie in and play the church. That used to be in Cloverdale, over out of Tillamook. This in their minutes during Prohibition, they made a motion. And if you just read it the first time, it sounds like they approved of the use of a drink. But when you read it a little further, then you read it like Sister Rhonda right off, like it's actually put in their minutes.
Yeah,
they took a stand against it to make sure that everybody was clear. They did not, even though that was
never had been their practice.
So it was after Prohibition, because this became legal.
Yeah.
And they made it clear that they did not believe that, practice that, whatever. But the first initial sentence in their minutes, it kind of sounds like they did. You just have to read a little further. You have to read, it's like anything else, you have to read the whole paragraph. But they make it very clear they just not have respect. And I mean, I know we go over there. I mean, probably a few of these churches in there. May go right through that lineage. But that's exactly what she's talking about.
Okay. So know and be aware of that. Not only there in England, but and we'll give attention to. We've been talking about just the transition in churches coming across. Last weekend I taught, and on Friday night, we talked about the Welsh Tract Baptist Church that is in the stated in the lineage. It was one of the original churches from the Philadelphia Association. Who wrote down what year that was and just exactly where that was located? What state particularly? I don't think that's even stated here in the way we have our lineage wrote out most of the time, most commonly.
Delaware,
yes. And at when did the origin of that church, at least here in the United States, take place?
1701.
Okay. Associated with that, the pastor at that time in 1701 was an individual by the name of Thomas Griffin. Sometimes in history, it's going to be Griffin. Historians back in the 1700s and 1800s many times would misprint because a lot of it was handwritten and because a lot of those records were done and set that way. So in looking recently at some history for that Welsh Tract Church, Welsh Tract Baptist Church, it is now, there is a church still there in Delaware, in Newcastle County. Newark, Delaware, built by Welsh settlers. The building was in 1746. Their history goes on in names and dates exactly the way we have it, 1701, with Elder Thomas Griffith and a number of others who came directly from the churches in Wales, England. Okay, from three or four or five of the independent churches, not from London, not from the group of particular or general Baptists, either one, but from the independent Baptist churches in Wales. The Welsh Tract, and this is how it's recognized historically, most modern times, and I'll get to some of this later also. The Welsh Tract Old School Baptist Church is stated in this article as a historical primitive Baptist church located on Welsh Tract Road in Newark, Newcastle County, Delaware, built by Welsh settlers from a simple rectangle brick building with wood shingled roof. One of the other things that's going to come up, especially in the from the mid-1700s, after they come here to the United States, Baptist churches starting, to the early 1800s, is another distinction that Christian doesn't give a whole lot of attention to in his writings, but you'll see it in a lot of modern historians, modern records. Is the distinction between old school Baptists and new school Baptists. What do you think that would be talking about? Did I hear somebody chuckling about that already? Just mention it. Even in the late 1700s, there was division, particularly with this Welsh Tract Baptist Church. I'm going to skip down. I'm not going to read the whole article, but I do want to recognize the major second part of this article about this Welsh Tract Church, and it is the one that our lineage runs through here in the United States, first one that came over from Wales, England. The Welsh Tract Baptist Church continued in union with the Philadelphia Association. Remember I stated last time it was one of the original churches. It was part of that. of which it was a co-founder church, until the church was dismissed from the association to form the Delaware River Old School Baptist Association in 1836.
Okay.
So from the founding of the Philadelphia Association what was the year of that? I don't remember.
1907?
No, that was the founding of the Wealth Tract Church. I don't remember exactly when it was. Well, it was only about 10 or 11 years after this time, though, that those five Welsh churches got together. So they were part of that Philadelphia Association, Baptist Association, for just about 20 years. They withdrew from that. I'll read it the way that it's stated here. Until they were dismissed from the Philadelphia Association to form the Delaware River Old School Baptist Association in 1836 under the pastorate of Elder Samuel Troth. And so this is the full, this is over 100 years after they were organized. The Old School Baptists separated themselves from a majority of the Baptist churches in America at the time, then in 1836. They separated themselves from the majority of Baptist churches in America who formed the Triennial Convention in 1814.
Mm.
Now, the Triennial Convention is mentioned in second book. I don't know if anybody mentioned. Anybody know the history of that? What was the Triennial Convention here in the United States all about? Does Josh?
We'll have Sean talk about this years ago, but a group of Baptist churches who had to come together to support and raise funds to support a Methodist missionary.
Protestant missionaries. Baptists were doing that.
But the convention was also made up of individuals who were paying big bucks. It wasn't just church. So it was a carnal thing.
The Triennial Convention, yes, and it was filled up with almost as many or more, especially their leaders. Community and religious leaders who many of them were Protestant and not even Baptist at the time, they organized what was called the Triennial Convention. Now, that's generally recognized a Baptist organization, but it was even at the time about half Protestant and as many individual men in it that there were even representing churches. Okay, that were interested and involved in international mission work, but they were supporting, to begin with, a bunch of Protestants who didn't even come and have their origin in Baptist churches. Okay, so they separated from that, and that is the beginning, most of the time, when you read about the separation between Old School Baptists, of which this is one of the first churches that was ever called that, and New School Baptists. The New School Baptists were already at that time in 1814, when this Triennial Convention came. Sorry, I get the dates wrong. Fellowshipping with, participating with, and supporting Methodists and other missionaries internationally. That was the New School Baptists. At just about the same time, and some of those churches that were part of this original Triennial Convention were Southern Baptist churches that became, that later organized, and the Southern Baptist Association became even bigger and better convention.
Well, the Triennial Convention, that's one of the big three.
One of the predecessors of the SBC, the Southern Baptist Convention, yeah.
Well, the main guy who started the fundamentalist movement was the main leader who started this triennial.
This Triennial Convention.
Yeah.
Yeah, of the fundamental Baptists. So let me at least finish this paragraph. And they separated themselves then from the majority of the Baptist churches in America who went into that Triennial Convention due to what the Old School Baptists considered novel practices not found in the New Testament regarding first missionary societies. And then Bible societies. You know what Bible societies are? There's the Gideons and all the other independent individuals that promote all the other English versions of the Bible. Those didn't even come from Protestant denominations. They came from Bible societies. Even before the market was flooded with other versions of English Bibles, Baptists were pulling themselves out from them because they saw the dangers in that and weren't going to be a part of it. Okay? Some of the other things that they withdrew from, that they saw as error in that day because of how it was being ran and promoted by the Protestants, though. This is one that we hold on and defend and promote all kinds, isn't it? Sunday school. Why would they be resistant of Sunday school? These old school Baptists didn't want to have anything to do with Sunday school because they were introduced by and were organized by, and the curriculum that was being used and the pulpit affiliation that was built in as a part of that, and the teachers that Sunday school organizations put together was going to be ran by, if not the Triennial Convention, then the Southern Baptist Convention type organizations that took the control, that took the administration of Sunday school out of the independent churches. That's why when you read about the beginning of Sunday school, first in England, then here in the United States, a whole lot of independent Baptist churches didn't want to have anything to do with Sunday schools. We run them today, hopefully with full control of the congregation and the individual church that's doing it, but that's not how it was originally set up. That's why they protested and wouldn't have anything to do with Sunday school in the 1800s. That seems completely backwards to us. So if you read through and understand how they were organized and where they came from and how they were introduced even to independent Baptist churches, then you can see why they were so late and so long in having it. It wasn't that they were against Christian education. They were against having Protestants write the material for it and oversee and administer and dictate to them how those Sunday schools were going to be done. Okay. Because of that, some of the other things that continue with this, even ministerial education, and sometimes by historians, revival meetings, and the like, they didn't participate in any of those. What's wrong with having revival meetings? We have revival meetings, don't we? What were revival meetings in the 1800s with the Triennial Convention, though?
Watch
out,
getting together.
It was pulpit affiliation.
Yeah.
And it was organized and deemed and dictated and particularly controlled by the convention, not by the local church praying and setting up and having the meeting and choosing who the speakers were going to be.
A lot of ecumenicalism.
Why do we not participate in... What's it even called today? I've never been a part of, and they call me every so often. Ministerial Alliance, even locally. And being involved in all the, if you're a pastor and haven't been called, you will, I'm sure. We're doing this, and we want you to be involved. Join arms and lock arms with us. So you got to be in agreement with this, right?
So don't even let our actions if we take part of it.
It creates corporate affiliation and control of citizen doctrine and practice. If Protestants are running those things, not our local churches, why do we stand on, why are we so particular about our doctrine and about administrator for baptism? And historically, those are reasons why that are not just in our time period, but things that real Baptists, independent Baptists have stood for and contended for ever since the Protestant Reformation.
So it's not something we just made up the last 20 years?
Yeah. We get accused of that a lot of times by people outside in the community that don't know the history and don't know why we're so independent. Well, you guys are just small and independent, and you never be a part of it, and you're never going to. How can you be against those things? Well, not against them. It's just against joining with and having others you can lead out in and participating even with those things. Okay, but Jim.
Is this how universalism sneaks its way in?
How many Baptist churches in the Northwest that I'm familiar with that have sometimes even changed their name so they're no longer even called Baptists? You know how that happens? It happens by universalism and pulpit affiliation and ministerial alliance and participating in those things until pretty soon they've lost their identity altogether. They're not even recognized as Baptist churches anymore. Sister Rhonda.
True story. 30 years ago, Catherine, California, Latimer Missionary Baptist Church with Linish, doctrine and practice up to the point, the pastor paid $80 a head for all of their teachers in that church to go to a Methodist church to learn how to worship God.
What? For a weekend seminary to pay for church members to go to. Yeah.
Yep.
That's the same thing that they stood against in the 1800s. This is the first church. We'll get to the second and third one maybe next weekend. What's the deal?
Yeah, we have the
rights
to,
I don't know,
we're...
You're outside, aren't you? I've never known you.
Travel and trade terms, so 1800s or whatever, in drought, and in violent dirt, the congregation of that were maybe even an outlet, leaf Baptists or whatever, and went over to people because... being a preacher, reading scriptures or whatever, and sometimes the whole church was going to turn for one book denomination instead of it.
Sure.
Because there was a man here, after all, he is a preacher.
It happens. Very rarely does it happen the other way that a Baptist church, I mean, a Protestant church will, as a whole congregation, I've heard of that happening once or twice. But more times than not, within a couple of decades, what's even sadder is to hear of churches that share our lineage that aren't even with us anymore. Not only we can't fellowship with them, but they're not even identified as Baptist churches anymore. That's all too common. And it always goes the same way. It's the practice of ministerial alliances and universalism because they did not practice and contend for the faith once delivered unto the saint. They compromise doctrine, compromise practice. They allow other teaching and doctrines to come in. Okay. Some other things about this particularly that we'll mention next time. Christian mentions it a couple of different times in both Volume 1 and Volume 2. The practice of laying on of hands, and sometimes it's an ordinance, sometimes not. Baptism, right now the main one that we've talked about, even though, what particularly about Baptists, about baptism, excuse me, about the ordinance of baptism. Believer's baptism, and even tonight, I hope it didn't shock people the way they talked about it, even though I think I did the first weekend that I was speaking about church history this school year. Succession. Succession for us in modern times and our general contention for succession is always church to church succession and lineage. Pay close attention because depending on who's writing about it, what takes place in ignorance, sometimes it comes up as, and remember, I think I told you either the first or second weekend it was going to be that way, didn't I? Succession of administrators, succession of pastors, more than succession of churches. Sometimes that's the Protestants' fault because they don't know and understand anything better. There's no excuse for Baptists not to know the difference. Succession and lineage has to go from church to church in a line that we've looked at in scriptures over and over again. If that can't be established, then nothing else about baptism really even matters. Okay? Thank you. We'll come back tomorrow then. Let Brother come up.